Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Jim McCarthy and James Sims about TEDx Broadway. Also, Peter and Michael review Manilow on Broadway, Moose Murders, Fiorello, Women of Will, All the Rage, and the Cabaret film. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 3rd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books to his credit, the most recent being the Broadway MVP's 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. You can find that on Amazon if you'd like. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, and Masterworks Broadway, as well as many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at the Sondheim Review and Broadway Stars. And also, Michael, little birdie told me that you're now writing for Talkin' Broadway. Is that true?
Yes. I started off with a review of Christine Andreas at 54 Below.
Excellent. Yeah. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at FileSpotPhoto.com and in many other places around the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So let's do some administrative work here. You mentioned 54 Below, and we talked briefly about some CDs last week from 54 Below. Did you want to clarify something?
Oh, yes. I misspoke. We were discussing the first two in apparently what's going to be a series of releases of live recordings from 54 Below, two great albums, one by Patti LuPone and the other by Norbert Leo Butz. And I think I said self-produced at one point, which is totally the wrong term. What I meant was Studio 54, 54 Below themselves are very involved in the production of the recordings. Apparently, the room was designed with the idea of being able to make high quality recordings. But I just wanted to make it clear that the recordings are actually released on Broadway Records, which is Van Deen's label. So I didn't want to misspeak on that, because the first two are really fantastic, and I look forward to a great many others.
Yeah, we had Van Deen on a few months back. Yes. We talked about Broadway Records, but Van Deen also produced the Broadway benefit concert up at Sandy.
Yeah.
It from all accounts, I didn't attend it, but it was a huge success insofar as not only raising money, but also bringing up many spirits in the community up in Connecticut where that tragedy happened right before
yes.
Christmas.
Yes.
All right, so this week, Peter, making the
yes.
pages of the New York Post, are you? Peter attended Barry Manilow's concert on Broadway after Barry recovered his voice. And Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about the show first, and then we'll talk about what happened after.
I guess Barry Manilow deserves a great deal of credit for performing, given the fact that he had been ill. He got up there and certainly did the songs, The Whole World Sings. It was a valiant effort. I will say that he wasn't in great voice, but you had to expect that. I will also say that very few in the audience might have cared, considering the fact that so many people there were rabid fans, which brings me to the altercation I had and the article that came in the Post. I have to say that God forbid they could have called me and got my side of the story.
Oh, no, it's the New York Post. Are you, what, are you kidding?
You know, I'm in the Manhattan phone book. All my columns have links. You know, I mean, really, as they say in How to Succeed, really, what's the harm? You know, I mean, why not call me and find out my side of the story? I do understand why they jumped to one conclusion. But let me say that as soon as Barry Manilow came out, a great number of people in front of me stood. I thought, all right, well, they'll sit down after the first number. No, they didn't.
By the way, Peter, what row were you in?
Oh, sorry. I was in row E, fifth row on the aisle.
Okay.
So, all right, after the second number, they'll sit down. During the third number, when I saw they weren't going to sit down, I thought, you know, I'm going to go to the men's room. And I think that's why the Post said I went to get an usher. I did not go to get an usher. But I can understand why they inferred that, given the fact that I did leave my seat and storm up the aisle, figuring by the time I came back, they would sit down. So, all right, they're not sitting down still. So I'm in my seat saying, sit down. Sit down with half closed eyes. I'm being ignored. So finally, I stand, go right to their row, D, and snarl as if I'm talking to dogs. You know, sit down right now. So, yes, would they say Peter pitched a fit in the Post? Yes, that part is accurate, no question. Well, they did for one song, but, you know, it just overtook them, the power of Manilow and their devotion to him. Both of the women were crying. It mentioned in the Post that the women were crying, but they claim a house manager came down and castigated the woman, and that put her into tears. No. For that matter, no house manager ever came down. So that's an inaccuracy in the Post. Adam Feldman, by the way, has since gone online, both on All That Chat and on Facebook, to verify that part of it, that no house manager came down to chide the ladies. But they were in tears because they were so moved by Barry Manilow. And I don't criticize that. I mean, I have been moved to tears by so many things. So I understand that point of view. An usher did come. Oh, let me say this, that finally the two men in front of them who knew them, and the Post claimed they were all part of Clive Davis's entourage. I did see Clive Davis in row D in the middle, but he wasn't any part of this altercation. Anyway, the two men then got up and changed seats with the ladies. And I thought that was really smart because one of them, though, went back, I think, to get an usher to complain about me, that I was ruining the good time, while the other guy sat and pretty much sat for the rest of the show. Eventually, he too was too moved by Barry Manilow and had to stand. But nevertheless, I thought that was a really good decision that he did that. Well, the usher came down the aisle and looked for about 14 seconds, saw that nothing was happening, and left. So anyway, I was amazed this made the Post because nothing beyond that happened. I mean, for example, if it had broken out into a fist fight, then I can see it making the Post. But I was never out of control enough that I was going to escalate it because I knew I'd be in the wrong. I mean, one of my friends recently said, you know, this happened to me in Tango Argentino, and I hit the woman over the head with a playbill. No, I was never close to doing that because then I'm in the wrong. The woman did threaten to call the police on me. She said, I'm going to call the police on you. I said, I'll make a deal with you. If you don't, if you sit down for the rest of the show, I will not tell them that you're taking pictures. I mean, she had a video camera. The other woman had a camera. But the thing was, I knew that was a hollow threat because
everyone was taking
pictures. And, you know, I don't even recall hearing before the show an announcement not to take pictures. So maybe that's even allowed at this Barry Manilow thing. I don't know. So anyway, this is a real conundrum. I mean, do people have the right to stand and block other people, or do they not? And I think the decision I've come to is what they should do for things like this is to say, okay, the center section is for real fans who want to stand. You know, given that they love – the person who they'll be seeing more than other people, they are entitled to the center section of the orchestra, and they can stand all they want. Other people who do not want to stand and do not want people standing in front of them should be on the left and the right. Now, those aren't as good seats, yes, but they aren't as big fans as the people in the middle. So I think that's what should happen.
That's a good idea.
At shows like this. That's my compromise. But I was – even though she at one point finally say, "I'm not afraid of you." And while I thought about saying, "Well, maybe you should be," I decided, nope, I am not escalating this. I've done as much as I can. I am not going to put myself in the wrong. I knew it would put myself in the wrong. But when she threatened to call the police, I said, "The police? They're going to be on my side. You're not supposed to be doing this." And, I really feel bad that I ruined her good time. She did. She was there to have a good time. She can't believe that this wet blanket didn't feel the power that she felt, So these are the downsides of being in an orchestra seat, I have to say, in a situation like this. I feel bad for my girlfriend, too, because she was looking forward to this evening. Barry Manilow meant something to her when she was young, and the poor soul spent the whole night wondering if somebody was going to pull out a gun or, if it was going to go into an altercation. So I really feel bad about that part of it, too. I just wish it hadn't happened. I have no other explanation for what happened than what I have here. But I'm amazed that such a comparatively benign incident made the Post. And,
well, the article was mostly a piece of crap. I mean, it wasn't, as I recall, I made a point of noticing it was not signed. There was no byline. So, why don't they just stop? Why don't they just close up? They are such a rag. I mean, if I can have a parenthetical moment here, remember when there was that awful ferry crash a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you see what the headline was on the Post?
Oh, I can't even.
Cap'n Crunch.
Oh.
Which first of all, makes light of a very serious situation in which dozens of people were seriously hurt. And second of all, implies they had already decided that the captain was somehow necessarily responsible. And I think that they should all go to jail.
Well, we should we could talk about the Post for hours. I mean,
yes,
the Post had a terrible, terrible front page about a month or two ago about a gentleman that got pushed onto the subway tracks.
Yes,
about to be killed. And a Post photographer took the Post and took the photograph, and they ran it on the front page of the Post with a terrible headline. And anyway, we could talk about the Post for hours.
Yeah, we won't. I just wanted to slip that in. But
wanted to talk about the rock concert versus a Broadway show. Was Manilow's concert? Was it a concert? I shouldn't say a rock concert, but a concert versus a Broadway show. Do you think? How did that fall into place? And other Broadway shows that do have various audience participation standing a la Mamma Mia or Joseph's Mega Mix or things like that. But those are sort of at the end of the show and everybody gets up on their feet, but you don't have everybody standing for the whole show.
Well, interestingly enough, there is one point in this show where Manilow tells or asks, depending how you want to phrase it, the audience to stand. It's towards the beginning. I think the song is "I Can't Smile Without You." And he specifically asked them to stand for that one, but only for that one. But that's complicitly gives sort of permission to some people to think that they can stand for the whole thing. I didn't go to the same performance Peter did, but the one I went to, I would say the people in the first two rows stood through the entire performance.
When Minnelli on Minnelli was done, there was a guy who gave her a standing ovation after every number. Fine, that I understand.
That's okay. Different. That's different.
I think that's where everybody should compromise too. You want to show your devotion to the star. Fine. I have no problem with people showing devotion to the star, but I think really that's the way to do it. At the end of every number, while we're waiting for him to do the next one or her, stand, enjoy, and then sit down while the number's occurring. Or I really do believe my center section solution is. Mm-hmm. So
well, but also
I mean, first of all, I can't understand why, you know, why is standing, is that much more exciting than sitting, you know, for a whole show? I don't get that. But also, as I said, I haven't seen many rock concerts in my life. I think only two or three, and they were at the Garden. But, you know, a major point to keep in mind here is that the way those places are set up, in terms of the seating, it's an entirely different situation. If you're seated on the floor at Madison Square Garden and watching a rock concert, the stage is so high that even if everyone was standing in front of you was standing up, you could still see the performer even if you remained seated. I think that's true. And as far as the upper sections, they're raked enough that, again, if the person directly in front of you was standing, you could probably still stay seated and see the performer. But that is not the case in a Broadway orchestra. It's just not true. So if for no other reason than that, you know, there's a huge difference there. You know, I guess it's just a different sensibility. But people should keep that in mind, and maybe it shouldn't have been in a Broadway theater in the first place. But if it was, and since it was, then perhaps people should observe different modes of behavior.
So Michael Dale on Facebook posted that Barry sang "I Made It Through the Rain" and dedicated it to Hurricane Sandy victims. Did that happen in your performances?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it didn't come across as cheesy as it sounds.
Okay. Okay. And then, as Peter mentioned, that Barry was coming off of the flu and had lost his voice and may not have been a great voice. Well, we should just say it. Was he singing live?
Well, I don't know. I got the impression that there were maybe at least some places where he were, and I asked the press agents for a statement, and they said no statement. So you can make of that what you will.
I couldn't see, so I have no idea.
That's yet another thing that I believe that's more accepted in the rock world. Although it's so interesting that this should happen right now, because with all of this brouhaha about Beyonce. Exactly. But I remember there was a situation a few years ago where Bette Midler and Cher got into a conflict in the press about this. But I can't remember now which one. I suppose maybe it was Cher, who supposedly was lip syncing for part of her show, and Bette Midler made an issue of it, or maybe it was vice versa, but I'm pretty sure it was that way. You know, I don't know how often it's done in rock concerts. I think it tends to be done in maybe in numbers where there's more movement. You know, if it's like a dance number that, you know, that Cher has a lot of kind of big production numbers. But I don't know. I don't know what the percentage is. I don't know, you know, how accepted it is, how much people generally care. And we should also keep in mind that there have been some, not many, but some publicized instances in the Broadway theater, most notably the title song of Phantom of the Opera, or at least the second part of it, the second half of it. And when Liza Minnelli did the act, there was a huge deal made over the fact that in one section that she was singing to track, because again it was a big dance number.
So I didn't see Manilow on Broadway, but you two have. During his show, did he talk about his Broadway roots?
No, but he did. You know, it's funny, going in, David Barber, the editor of what used to be called Theater Crafts and Lighting Dimension, said to me, "Ha, you think he'll do a song from Harmony," which was his Broadway-bound musical that closed in California. And of course, he meant there isn't a chance in the world he'll do a song from Harmony. He did a song from Harmony.
He did.
He really did. Yeah. So at least that. No, he didn't say anything about way back when being on Broadway or off Broadway. Though I know he does have that history. So.
And also, I guess he must have put that song from Harmony on an album, because when he sang it, it did sound familiar to me. I mean, not as familiar as, you know, his big hits, but I definitely had heard it, and it seemed like the audience, most of the audience knew it also, and I thought it was a wonderful song. I would love to get to see that show at some point. And he indicated that
I
there
think
is
that, yeah.
some movement with it.
I think we're going to see Harmony in the next 2 years or so. Harmony played out in California, then did a Philadelphia, I think it was Philadelphia stop. Patrick Wilson starred in it. And
Danny Burstein.
Danny Burstein, that's right.
Yeah.
About Phantom, I have to mention this because there's a very good young adult novel out there now called Better Nate Than Ever by Tim Federle. And in fact, on Tuesday, there's going to be an event at the Drama Bookshop where Thomas Schumacher from Disney is going to interview Tim. And the book is really marvelous, not just for the young adults, by the way. It'll take you back to when you were just crazy obsessed with Broadway and want to know everything about it. So anyway, you know how people sometimes say, is the Pope Catholic? Or they talk about a bear's defecating habits in the woods. You know, they use those expressions to mean, you know, isn't it obvious? Okay.
Right.
Nate's expression in the book is Christine Daae's high note pre-recorded in Phantom? You know, so that gives you an indication of what this book is like, and I recommend it highly.
Oh, Peter, they sent me a copy. I you keep saying how wonderful it is. I really have to get to it. It sounds great.
Yeah, I think you'll really relate to it. I mean, we all were that kid once upon a time. So, though he has more guts than many of us, so yes. that'll come up.
Before we move on off of Manilow, I wanted to let everybody know that Barry did an interview with NPR a few weeks ago where he talked about his growing up on Broadway and playing piano in a lot of pits on Broadway. And it was a great interview. I'm going to put it in the show notes so that you can listen to it for yourself. If you're a Manilow fan, as I am a huge Manilow fan, you should go listen to it.
You stood in front of me?
Only because it was you in back of me? No, I mean, I have. But it's quite possible I might have stood or at least leaned forward in my seat a lot.
Lean forward is fine.
All right. So moving on, we have another Broadway legend, Moose Murders, that Peter got a chance to see. Is this the first New York production since it closed on Broadway?
I believe it is. I mean, it's been done around the country.
Yeah, New York production. So tell us about it.
It stinks. it's terrible. A lot of people have an issue with the way it's directed and performed by this beautiful soup company, Theater Collective, to be more accurate, that is of a community theater level. And I'm not as sure of that as many people are. I think they really pretty much played the show, and that's where they got into trouble. Yeah, I saw 11 minutes of the original Moose Murders. I was invited to a preview. I had just got back from out of town after doing a business trip, and my girlfriend met me there. And after 11 minutes, we really thought we had better things to do, so we left. If we knew that it was going to turn out to be such a legend, you know, we would have stayed. So we left right at the point in the original production where the quadriplegic is wheeled in the wheelchair. And given the fact that there had already been a blind man for whom was the butt of the jokes, that was part of the reason we left, too. I mean, playwright Arthur Bicknell thinks that the handicapped are fun to watch. I mean, that's one of the real concepts that's going on here. So this time we thought we'd give it another try. I remember calling Linda and saying, okay, January 30th, Moose Murders. And she said, oh! And I said, you know something? This is going to be one of those where we're looking forward to it. And 5 minutes into the show, we're going to be saying, why are we here? It didn't take her that long, believe me. And she was in the night air as soon as the intermission broke. I stayed for the whole thing. Just out of curiosity. But again, this is not the same show that was at the O'Neill 30 years ago, almost to the day, by the way, because it does say Moose Murders, and then in parentheses, shamelessly revised. So so you don't even get the benefit of seeing exactly what happened back in 1983. It doesn't know if it wants to be a comedy. It doesn't know if it wants to be a farce. It doesn't know if it wants to be a parody of an Agatha Christie play, but all things considered, it It is so ridiculous and over the top. And again, people are criticizing the actors, but I say the script, that it just it insults your intelligence in every way, and you really hate yourself for even being there. So it's one of those ideas that sounds good on paper. Let's give people a chance to see this legendary flop that ran one night. But, you know, again, once you're there, what's the point? It stinks. It stinks. It's really terrible.
All right. So... Michael, you got a chance to see Fiorello. Why don't you tell us about that?
I did. I was disappointed. I've seen, let's see, well, three previous productions. The first Encores production 20 years ago. How amazing is that? With Jerry Zaks as Fiorello. Mm-hmm. I saw it. They did it on Staten Island some years ago with Tony LoBianco as Fiorello, and it was quite good. And then I just saw it at NYU just about 6 months ago, maybe. And as we've discussed before, this is the Steinhardt School. They do wonderful productions with, you know, 30-piece orchestras and wonderful production values and very professional performances by the kids. And I may have mentioned that Sheldon Harnick was there. I actually went to a dress rehearsal, and we chatted about it. This one, it was a combination of things. It just didn't quite gel. First of all, Fiorello is played by Danny Rutigliano, or Rutigliano. I'm not sure how he pronounces it. And it was interesting. He was absolutely perfect for it in terms of height and look and type and general, you know, personality. But he just didn't have that extra something that, you know, the charisma. I didn't really see any of that. He really did not seem charismatic at all. He seemed, you know, mostly kind of argumentative and belligerent, and that didn't really work well at all. And also, I don't know, he just, in terms of the acting, it didn't seem organic to me. It seemed to me that he was doing a lot of indicating. So obviously that's a huge flaw in itself. Also, Kate Baldwin was quite lovely as Taya, but really she was miscast physically, I thought, in terms of not looking remotely Italian, because that is a kind of major part of the plot. And also, this is, now here's an interesting thing. The Encore shows, I believe it's fair to say that the books are always edited to some degree. But maybe to varying degrees. And in this case, I don't know the show well enough to know how much they took out, but I think they took out a fair amount, because the show was shorter than when I have seen a full production of it, considerably shorter. And as a result, the effect it had to me was it made it seem a lot more episodic, and it kind of made it seem that it really didn't flow very well at all, which I never had that experience in the other three productions I had seen. Now, the original Encores one, I think, cut most of the book, so that maybe that doesn't apply. But the two fully staged productions I saw, I thought they flowed better. They seemed more coherent. This one, I suppose it was probably also partly lackluster direction by Gary Griffin, who I don't think this is the kind of material that he's best suited for. So it was a disappointment. On the other hand, bright spots, Jen Gambetta's was much more delightful and wonderful than anything I've seen her in before. Partly probably because the material was a lot better. She was in a couple of things that really were not good as far as material, namely Tarzan and All Shook Up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Erin Dilley is lovely as Marie. And Shuler Hensley, one can see why Ben Brantley went crazy over him in the New York Times review, which was basically started out with maybe two or three paragraphs on how terrific Shuler Hensley is in this show as Ben Marino. He just, you felt like this was that person up there on stage. It's a great, great performance. It has the humor, you know, it has the you understand exactly where he's coming from. It's a complicated character, and he gets all shades of it. This part was played originally by the great Howard Da Silva. So you can imagine that it's, you know, a pretty meaty role. So he was fantastic. Adam Heller is great. Andrew Szymanski. Lots of individual, wonderful people. And of course, you know, it sounded great. Rob Berman did a great job conducting. But yeah, it just didn't flow. That was my main thing. And things like, I don't remember, Emily Skinner played Mitzi, who comes in the middle of Act Two and sings Gentleman Jimmy. And it seemed like this time it seemed like a complete non sequitur to me. And I also had never gotten that feeling before. It just seemed so abrupt. And I have to say, the applause was very tepid after the number for that reason, I think. It's not that she didn't do it well.
But that's so George Abbott. You know, George Abbott used to love to throw in diegetic entertainments whenever he could. Think about Pajama Game, where there's Union Rally with Steam Heat. Think about Damn Yankees, where there's the show for Joe Hardy, where they do Who's Got the Pain. He did that. He just thought it was perfectly fine to have any excuse at all for a number, if indeed the number were entertaining enough. So here we are, and here's a fundraiser, I guess. Is that what it is? A party for James J. Walker, who later got his own musical that isn't nearly as good, but that's another story.
But also the way and again, I guess this must have been done the same way the last times I saw it, but the way it is here, she comes in alone, Mitzi, and she sings the number by herself, and it stops, and there's like tepid applause. And then the chorus girls come on, and they dance the number, but nobody sings again. And it just didn't build. You know, it seemed like it should have ended with a vocal as well, and it didn't. So it's an oddly constructed moment. And I felt that more this time for some reason.
I remember 1965, Arthur Lawrence wrote an article for the Times talking about musicals, and this was the moment he cited more than any other for Fiorello. He explained the whole scene and gave some dialogue along the lines, "Hey, Missy, let's see those tapping feet." Believe me, that's not the line, but it was a line like that. And he followed it by saying, "Fiorello won the Pulitzer Prize." You know, so that was his assessment. You know, that the Gentleman Jimmy was reason enough that Fiorello should not win a Pulitzer Prize.
All right, so it is ending today, but Peter, you're going to go see it this afternoon. Is that correct?
Yep.
All righty. Yep.
Actually, I couldn't go to the opening because my wonderful friend Josh Ellis, who used to be Broadway's most significant press agent until he retired, is doing a show about his own experience of being a press agent. Stories about Carol Channing, Yul Brynner, Bertha Kitt, Sandy Duncan, all that. And he was trying it out for a bunch of friends, and so that's why I wasn't there. First things first, I wanted to be loyal to Josh. It was the third time I saw it. I guarantee you, when he's ready to do it for an audience, you're going to have a really enjoyable time. I liked his original title, Ellis in Wonderland, but now it's called A Camel Ride Down Broadway. And I'm not going to tell you why it's called that, but nevertheless, that's what it's called now. So that's why I was not at the opening of Fiorello, but it was time well spent hearing stories of Broadway of yore and his adventures in the trenches.
All right, but you did get a chance to go out and see Women of Will at the gym at Judson. So why don't you tell us about that?
This is a show where Tina Packer, who certainly runs the Shakespeare Theater out in Weston, Massachusetts, was the power of the show, because after all, we are talking about the women in Shakespeare's plays. So she's devised not a one-woman show, because she certainly needs somebody to play off of. There's no question about that. And Women of Will tells us that Shakespeare actually, his plays could be divided into five different areas dealing with women, that that there were some times that he wrote plays where they were victims, you know, and times where they were stronger. And it's a long evening. It's close to 2:45. I'll tell you that. But nevertheless, watching Tina Packer is so fascinating because she's a large woman and she's not a young girl. And I don't think I'm saying anything that she would disagree with. And yet she becomes a young girl when she's Juliet, and she becomes a young girl when she's Desdemona, and she becomes a strong woman when she's Margaret in Henry VI, Part III. I was hoping that she would do that. I expected her to, frankly, because Queen Margaret in that play has a dynamite speech where a person who expected to be king is challenged by her, in which she she lets him know that she doesn't think he's kingly at all. Nigel Gore is her partner, and he does a nice job in a supporting role, because I mean these are all both women. It's really a master class, frankly, but the most entertaining master class in town, I dare say. So for those who feel, I'd like to know more about Shakespeare. I'm a little intimidated by Shakespeare. I need to be spoon-fed Shakespeare, all that type of thing. This is a very good time to go because she's really quite wonderful, and so is the way that she dispenses the information, where she sets up the scenes and tells you what to look for and why the women in these scenes behave the way they did. So I recommend it highly, especially for those who really felt that Shakespeare was a bit beyond them. No, it's not anymore.
All righty. Michael got a chance to see Martin Moran's new show, All the Rage, at one of the Peter J. Sharp theaters. This is the one on 416 West 42nd Street. But Michael, tell us about that.
Yeah, by the way, Martin in the show jokes about that. So I guess we're not the only ones who've noticed how confusing that is. That there are four, I believe, Peter J. Sharp theaters. But anyway... The show is called All the Rage, and it's a very, very well written and well performed one man show about basically, the nature of forgiveness. What exactly does forgiveness mean, and can it be achieved? In what situations can it be achieved? It's about anger that some people carry around and how various people deal with their anger, and he gives several different examples from his life to demonstrate how he himself deals with this subject. One of them is his relationship with his stepmother, which apparently was very fraught. And then several other another main one is this refugee that he winds up counseling, this guy who had been a victim of torture in his country. And so it seemed somewhat diffuse in the sense of all of these different hopping around into different incidents and characters from his life, as compared with Martin's previous one-man show, which was called The Tricky Part, and which was a really extraordinary show. Did you see it, Peter?
No.
I remember it getting tremendous reviews, and I think it was nominated for and maybe even won several awards. That was about Martin's experience of being sexually abused when he was a kid. So that was more focused just by its very nature, because it was primarily about that one situation and then how he dealt with it growing up and how he later, many years later, confronted the abuser. That was a more focused show. This one is more diffuse, but it's still very interesting, and it's he's talented enough as a writer that he keeps bringing it back to the main theme of forgiveness and anger and getting over rage. So I would recommend it. It's directed by Seth Barish, and it's in the small space. This Peter J. Sharp Theater is the small space upstairs at Playwrights Horizons. So it's a perfect size for an intimate little show like this. And I do highly recommend it.
All right, and to wrap up our reviews here, Michael attended the cabaret showing of the film over at the Ziegfeld. So, Michael, tell us how that went.
Well, it was very exciting. I had previously one time been in the audience in a screening of Cabaret where Liza Minnelli was in the audience. That was in the late 90s as a benefit for Broadway Cares, if I recall. But interestingly enough, even for that occasion, they could not find a decent print of the movie. To make a long story short, Cabaret is one of those movies that had not been well tended over the years for a number of reasons. It was not made by a major studio. It's ABC Pictures, I think, in association with someone else. And it was almost... In a real way, it was almost like this indie movie that became this tremendous success and won 8-9 Oscars or something, and probably would have won Best Picture if The Godfather hadn't happened to be the same year. But so for a number of reasons, it has not been well attended, and so a couple of years ago. At most, a major digital restoration was done. And I think it was first shown last year in LA as part of the Turner Festival out there. And then I had seen it actually just a few months ago at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens. But on this occasion, here we were in the Ziegfeld, the huge, beautiful Ziegfeld Theater, long may it stand. With a packed house of fans, not to mention such celebrities in the audience as Alan Cumming, Bernadette Peters, Phyllis Newman, Charles Bush, Arlene Dahl. I could go on and on. And all four of the major stars of the film, Liza Minnelli, Joel Grey, Marisa Berenson, apparently it's pronounced Marisa. People made a point of saying it that way. I didn't know that. And Michael York. Did I say Michael York?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you did. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I did. And Robert Osborne, the TCM host, the evening began with him interviewing all four of them, which, you know, was incredible to have all of them there talking about the movie and then to see it. And I believe they all four stayed to watch it again too. There's something indescribable about watching a really classic film with one or more of the stars in attendance. And also, as we've discussed before, it's a great, great film, very different from the show version in many respects, but also at its core, I think, very, very similar. And of course, a great deal of the score was carried over to the movie. So I was in absolute heaven. I don't think I'll ever have a better experience of seeing Cabaret than on this occasion.
On Monday, January 28th, 2013, at New World Stages, we attended the TEDx Broadway event, which is sort of like the TED events, but it's a independently organized TED event, as they say. It's not the big TED event that they have twice a year around the world. But James Sims was there. James is a Huffington Post blogger, and he's also the social media manager at Lincoln Center, and was there at TEDx Broadway. And good evening, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is your second time. This is only the second time TEDx Broadway has happened, but you were there last year and this year. And tell me, what did you think about this year?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that it was like a lot of tech conferences. I tend to go a lot of these. It was hit and miss. I think, as you see a lot of conference speakers do, they state a lot of the obvious sort of things. I did feel like it definitely picked up towards the end. The day was sort of broken up into three parts. And the third part to me was much more of the forward thinking part of the day. You had some speakers that were really sort of on their game a little bit and were thinking outside the box. I think the first part of the day was very much, maybe it was sort of to prime those in the audience that still aren't on board with this, you know, really forward-thinking mentality. Or they left last year's TEDx Broadway and, you know, thought great, but really didn't take a lot of action after that. You know, the one thing that I had talked to the organizers ahead of time to sort of do a preview article for the Huffington Post, and during our chat, one of the things they really emphasized was, you know, these are not meant to sort of have to-do lists to take away and go back and sort of implement, because really, if you're giving to-do lists, you're not asking for big ideas to come out of this. You're really just saying, well, here's one idea and here's 10 ways to do it. And so, you know, there were a lot of big ideas, I think, sort of mentioned both times. Some great, some a little off the mark, but I think it was positive because it got people talking.
So what are some of the big ideas that you mentioned this year, and who were your, some of your favorite presenters this year?
Yeah. The first that I was really sort of most interested in hearing from was David Sable, who's the head of digital media for the National Theatre of Great Britain. And he's a young guy who, as he said in his speech, sort of got into running the digital team at the National Theater without really having any digital experience and really not having much deep sort of theater administration side to his professional portfolio. But to me, that is a sort of an inspiring thing in that he came in and was already able to think outside the box because he wasn't sort of constrained with this is the way theater is done. And I was most intrigued to hear from him because, as he pointed out, the National Theater has incorporated into its mission statement this need to create engaging digital content. And to me, I think that's this core big idea that has to sort of resonate across any sort of institution. I look at this sort of from the nonprofit institution side of things, where mission statements really exist, as opposed to perhaps the for-profit side of Broadway. And obviously Broadway has some nonprofit companies, Roundabout, Lincoln Center, you know, this, that, and the other. But incorporating into a mission statement that one should like be forward-thinking, and that idea that digital content is not what the product of Broadway traditionally is thought of as, that is the work on a play, on a stage rather, a play, a musical. But if you're saying, let's think outside and how can Broadway sort of grow and be big in the future, as everyone points out, that's limited to the confines of a theater. You can't really expand beyond the walls of your theater and the seats in the house unless you think of new content. That's obviously sort of this digital conversation now. The National Theater puts it in its mission statement, and they were talking about the fact that they do these live broadcasts. Many people are familiar with the Met Opera's broadcasts in movie theaters. Memphis, the musical on Broadway, was recently broadcast by Fathom Events. It's a great sort of idea, but for an organization to get behind it, you have to want to experiment with it, right? And you have to figure out what works, what doesn't. And unless something like that's in your mission statement, there's no real way to try it, fail at it, and keep trying, because, you know, experimentation will often result in failure, but that doesn't mean you stop experimenting. You change a variable and try again. But if you're from the top down, if they're not sold on this idea that this is core to the mission, where's the incentive to keep trying? If you fail once, that's a lot of money down the drain, and there's nothing like a mission statement to force you to stay on track and keep making it work. And the National Theater, as David Sable pointed out, has proven that it works, but they had to experiment. And the experimentation to me is key over thinking of the future of Broadway, and not expecting immediate results and be willing to sort of take a step back, reevaluate, and go at it again. It's very almost scientific in trying to sort of get a new outcome out of the same formula. So I was really excited by David. He had some good ideas. Whether or not that's applicable across the boards of Broadway, maybe not, but I think he definitely got people talking. I felt like there was a little more buzz in the room after his chat than some of the other stuff throughout the day.
Some of the things that David talked about was the thought about cannibalization of your product, and that how people are afraid that if you do what the National Theater is doing, that people will not come to the theater. And he set aside those fears right away by saying that he felt that it expanded the market and they've seen no decrease in revenue there, and that people who weren't going to come are not going to come anyway. So it really doesn't affect it as much. I thought it was very important that he addressed that fact, and he went head on right into that.
I completely agree, and you know, that is certainly a built-in fear, I think, for many administration points of views. You know, obviously, if you put your product out there for cheaper elsewhere, well, how am I going to get the same butts in the seats? I think the idea there is, and the way the National Theater has understood it, is it's exposing you to a global audience, and you know, you think of digital. There's no more borders in that. This thing gets beamed to theaters everywhere. You're reaching audiences that A, may never be able to come to you, and B, it is almost a commercial for you, because as he was saying, people, it seems to have proven for them at least that those who were exposed to it in a theater then want to go to the National Theater when they take a trip to Great Britain. And it's this sort of entry point into the theater. I see no downside in letting people have a new entry point into the theater. Whether or not that completely translates the same experience, obviously that is sort of an artistic challenge, right? And I know the Met Opera sometimes is talked about in editorials over what do you sort of take away from the live experience in order to make the cameras fit in the theater and sort of hit a digital audience too. You know, these are things that the artistic directors need to take into account. But yeah, I think the National Theater really proved that they're not losing audience members. In fact, they're growing interest in their brand and the brand of theater, you know, as a product of itself. And I think that's great for everyone across the board, that there's more interest in theater. And, you know, there was another talk yesterday, or there was another talk that day, and it was about this idea that people, there was this equation with sports, right? And a Chinese group of kids being fascinated by basketball and them wearing, for instance, a LeBron James jersey, and yet, and they're huge fans of the sport, the team, yet they would never come and buy a ticket to come to Madison Square Garden because they are in China, would likely not have the money to ever travel to the United States, but they are a dedicated fan of the brand of that team. And the fact that they can experience that with broadcasts of games, go online, read the stats, get all this digital content based on it, they're still a fan. Do you discount them because they're not in your immediate butts in seat group? And is that not an audience to cultivate unto itself with this new product? That to me is the future of not just Broadway, but just live entertainment in general.
It was interesting to see the tables turned on people such as Terry Teachout, who is the drama critic at the Wall Street Journal. He was up on stage and gave a very enchanting speech. And Tom Schumacher, president of Disney Theatrical, getting up on stage and telling about their experiences as well. Certainly, Ted offered people who don't have the chance of getting in a room with Tom Schumacher or yes. Terry Teachout or the various other folks who have mentioned stuff. And also it brought a spotlight onto such wonderful little projects like the Theater for One that Christine Jones has shepherded onto the stage here. And I mean, I would say that I'm a pretty plugged-in person for the news on Broadway, you know, running Broadway Stars. I pretty much know everything that goes on, and I totally missed Christine Jones's Theater for One news cycle, if it were. Did you know about that? Did you see it before, Ted, yesterday?
I had only read about it, and I think it must have been on a Broadway World blog message board or something. There was chatter. To be honest, I didn't experience it, and I don't even think I walked through Times Square when it was there. I must have like avoided it by going down the other sides of the blocks as I normally do. But I'm actually really sad that I missed that, because it sounded like a really unique experience and a cool experiment on, you know, really driving home the intimacy factor of live theater. Now, you know, I somewhat question the theater for one, and that is theater only intimate, or are we also wanting that communal sort of factor? Like, what is there not this interest in feeling an emotion at the same moment others around you feel the same emotion? And I think of the way I experience, like, a movie. I'm much more involved in a movie when I'm in a theater and I have this sort of vibe that the people around me are getting as thrilled or as scared or as emotional as I am, compared to when I'm watching it on a DVD at home. And, you know, that is somewhat of an equivalent of, it's really intimate, it's just me and the TV screen. And sometimes it's not the same because the other people aren't there to clap when everyone's clapping. I mean, there's something to be said for a standing ovation and that thrill. So it's interesting. It's very unique. It certainly, you know, is a cool experiment. I don't know how much it translates from live, you know, that ultimate live theater experience. But I was fascinated to see that it took off the way it did and had a lot of buzz like that.
I was interested. The Theater for One presentation, I'll throw a link up on the show notes to for folks to take a look at it. But think of like a traditional photo booth that you get into, except for double the size of it, and the audience gets in, the one person member of the audience gets on one side and the actor gets in on the other side, and they perform whatever they're going to perform, and it's so close there, and I wonder if it's so much the theater for one or if it's the proximity to the actor, because I don't know. Did you have an opportunity to see Once down at New York Theater Workshop, then on the Broadway stage, and see how the change, the intimacy, the feeling of Once changed?
I did, and it's interesting, you know, that intimacy factor from when it's, you definitely see it when a show transfers from off-Broadway to Broadway. It happened with Once, and then the same New York Theater Workshop, Peter and the Starcatcher, to Broadway. And I felt like, you know, for me, for Once, I'll admit, I didn't sit far back when I saw it on Broadway. I sort of had a closer seat, so the intimacy factor was sort of still there. And I might need to go back and sit, you know, maybe in the mezzanine or something and see what it's like from that vantage point. But for Peter and the Starcatcher, I did sit further back. But then I had seen it at New York Theater Workshop as well. And that show, I did feel like it lost something of the intimacy. And both shows are sort of the same in that they're very bare bones. And it's a simple story told, you know, really uniquely. And there is maybe a little bit of magic lost there. You know, it's interesting. Once, obviously, it didn't matter for the box office. They're certainly bringing in the money, as was pointed out at TEDx. Of course, Peter and the Starcatcher, maybe not so lucky. They're making a shift over to, well, the New World Stages, where TEDx was. I guess they couldn't keep filling the Broadway house. But yeah, you know, the intimacy factor does leave, and does a big Broadway house need to have content that always takes advantage of the fact that it's a big house and fills it, or can intimacy live? I think Once is proving that at least a majority of the audience is going are certainly interested in a small show that I hope is still feeling intimate on a somewhat, you know, larger scale for people.
So let me finish up our conversation here by asking you, you're the social media manager at Lincoln Center. Did you feel like you were, you know, it was the most amazing event to have the seemingly godfather of social media, George Takei, giving us some wisdom there, which George's speech was, for me, it was inspirational. And it was insightful, and it was shocking because obviously I knew this conceptually in my head, but when he stood there and he said, "I'm 75 years old,"
I know.
I said, "That's not possible.
I know.
You look like you're in your 40s, and you embrace social media and the internet like a 30 or a 20-year-old, you know?" So tell me about your view on George Takei.
Well, first of all, who doesn't love George Takei? I mean, I'm certainly one of those people who loves him from the Star Trek age. And I love that he's a theater buff and a stage actor. I'd had the privilege of seeing him on stage out in Los Angeles some time ago. And, I mean, God love that guy. He is working social media like nobody's business. He gets it. I mean, he's almost like BuzzFeed. I don't know if you follow BuzzFeed at all, but they're about the cat photos. And he's adopted that. I mean, his method is, you know, post what's popular. He posts, you know, funny photos, cat photos, and then slip in the important messages here or there. And you have a wide audience who's receptive. You know, the one factor about George's speech, I loved every moment of it. And I thought it was great to sort of take some of those lessons back. However, he has one factor that no person that ever comes to Broadway, maybe other than Bill Shatner, now Patrick Stewart too. Well, there you go. They have that Star Trek other side. And to think George Takei very likely could tweet complete nothing and still have a huge following. I mean, he has the geek followers, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm certainly one of them. I followed him more for Star Trek purposes than anything else on Twitter. He does have that. So there's the celebrity factor. And the fact that he can build the buzz for a show as important as the one coming to Broadway with him and Leah Salonga, that's extremely important. And I think it's brilliant that he can translate, you know, his clout to something as important as this show about the Japanese internment camps. But of course, you know, if I were to try to replicate his sort of methods, it probably wouldn't get as popular as him. If Lincoln Center tweeted a picture of a crying cat, I have to wonder, would it really get picked up as much as George Takei? I might have to experiment with that. Let's see.
Well, when I first heard that he was doing this show, Allegiance, with Leah Salonga and various other folks started out at the West Coast, I said, there's great shows and then there's commercial shows and it's hard for those crossovers to happen, but they do happen occasionally. But I said, I don't know how you can raise money for a musical about Japanese internment camps. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you can get an audience for this, but seemingly they are doing this. And it is also based, you know, partially upon what George is doing in introducing a new audience to, to come to this show. So we'll have to see how it really shakes out in the end. I've always been very hesitant about the accolades that Next to Normal got for their social media presence and tweeting the show and things like that. I really felt like there was a lot of hysteria because it was Twitter and it was Broadway, and that it really didn't translate into much sales, and that I wondered really how it was effective. So, but I think that George Takei is really going to make an impact here, and we'll have to see when it actually happens.
I think so. To the Next to Normal point, I think that to their credit, they were early adopters of like trying something outside the box on social. I think that worked. The ROI on social, it's still not there. I mean, just because you have a great Twitter campaign doesn't mean you're going to get the ticket sales to translate. So it's an interesting sort of it's an interesting problem to have, that you know you have this whole other audience, which is your social media audience, you know, and the problem with digital, of course, is it's global. There are no borders to your social chatter on Twitter, really. And so if you're dealing with a show that's on the stage in New York, you know, how much of that audience is really your New York ticket buying audience to begin with? That's another question to sort of solve later on.
I was reading this morning, Bloomberg Business Week had a story about Evita closing at a loss. And and they brought up something that I thought was very interesting. They talked about Evita had 1.3 million likes on Facebook.
But what did that mean, really?
What did that mean? You know, if we're talking about it ran 46 weeks. You know, let's just guess here. If we're talking about 10,000 people, 10,000 seats that were purchased a week, which is high. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about in the 4.5 million range of number of tickets sold.
Yeah,
and I, you know what? I bet you that it's much less than that because they'd still be open if it was that high. But I again, we're going to have to see how the ROI for huge Twitter followers and Facebook likes and things like that, how that translates into ticket sales and keeps shows open and Broadway growing.
It's good to have buzz, right? But in the digital world, it's no longer local buzz. And so, you know, I have to imagine that a lot of the Evita following came because of Ricky Martin fans, maybe being interested in Ricky Martin. But I obviously, they didn't come flooding to Broadway, into that house at the Marquee. So, you know, just because you have a celebrity doesn't always mean everyone's going to come running to the show.
No, absolutely. So, in closing, TEDx Broadway's theme this year is, what is the best that Broadway can be? And let me ask you, do you feel like TEDx addressed that question?
I feel like TEDx got people inspired to ask themselves that question when they left, which I think was the point. I think they got people primed to think about the future of Broadway. I don't think there was a literal answer to what could Broadway be in the next 20 years. You know, there weren't diagrams up there pointing out the future. So it's interesting. It's like talking about the idea. It's really a challenge, I think. But they wanted it that way. I mean, the organizers really were trying to say that they wanted to inspire people to go back and talk about it further when they left TEDx Broadway. This was a way to prime the conversation.
All right. Well, James, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk about TEDx Broadway 2013 with us. And we'll see if there's a TEDx Broadway 2014.
I'm sure there will be.
Maybe we'll all get everybody down and bring us all in to answer the next set of questions.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
With us this morning, we have Jim McCarthy of Gold Star. He's also one of the co-organizers of TEDx Broadway that just wrapped up this week. And good afternoon, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So give me kind of a retrospective of what's happened with TEDx this week. How did you feel the event went?
I thought it went very well. I think one of the ways that Ken and Damien and I measure success is, did we have a good time? And I think we were all really happy with it. We were excited to see, I think on two levels, a very enthusiastic reception. We had a nice full house. And I think the audience, it's funny, all the speakers said, this is a really warm audience. This is an audience that's really receptive to what I'm doing on the stage, you know, whether as a performer or a speaker. And then I would say beyond that, in the sort of sphere of social media and the internet and everything, we actually had a tremendous amount of interest as the event was going on and then subsequently. So we're pretty happy about that.
Now, I've read before that you've attended the large TED events. Is that correct?
Yeah, I go there. You know, I have gone every year for the last several years, and I've been part of that community.
And so is TEDx Broadway the only TEDx event that you're a coordinator with? Have you ever attended others?
Well, I've been to others, certainly, but it's the only one. I did a kind of an internal event called TEDx Gold Star a couple years ago that really was just a simulcast kind of thing of the TED conference. But this is the only one that I'm actively involved in.
And you also co-organized last year's TEDx, which was the first one. How long did it take you between you had your first idea to have a TEDx Broadway and the first one last year?
Well, the story goes like this. Ken and Damien and I, over various, drinks and whatever over the years, had this notion that maybe a different kind of discussion about Broadway would be fun and would be that there would be an audience for such a thing and that there would be a purpose for such a thing. And then when TED launched the TEDx program several years ago, I was involved, not directly, but as a supporter in the community of that. And Gold Star was involved as a supporter, a corporate supporter of the TEDx program. And so once those things all kind of came together, I said, hey, guys, this is a format that probably suits us. And so we discussed it and kind of decided to give it a shot. I think we actually formally decided to apply for a license for TEDx Broadway in, I want to say, maybe March of 2011. And then, you know, really got off the ground with the planning and more like the middle of the summer, because there's a bit of a, you know, a licensing process and that kind of thing. And then did the first event in January of 2012. So we probably were at that for legitimately 5 or 6 months the first time around. But I think from the time we decided let's pursue this to the actual event, it probably almost took a year, I would say.
How much did you grow between last year and this year?
Well, you know, it's funny. The we were in the same building. Were you at both years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were in the same building, and our original intention was to just have it in that same stage because we're very mindful of the fact that part of the experience is the intimacy of it and the idea that you're there with not only the speakers but all these other folks, and the value comes from being able to talk to everybody. So we think about growth in a funny way because we don't want it to be too big. So the original thought was we'd put it on the same stage, which is the one that I think has Bear on it right now. And when we did it the first time, it was Million Dollar Quartet. So so we booked that space, and then as time went on, it became clear that there was demand that would exceed that space quite considerably. So we weighed the pros and cons of, you know, making the room bigger and decided it was worth it. And so we went up. So I think it's probably not quite double the size, but we sort of maxed the room out that we were in. And I think that's the biggest theater they have in New World Stages. So I think we were pretty happy with the size that it was this year.
What do you think is coming? I know it's early, but, you know, thoughts for next year. Are you going to look for the same venue, different venue? Are you going to look to grow it, or was this a comfortable size for you? Or
First of all, we haven't made any actual decisions about next year. I think our intention is, you know, let's do it again next year. But beyond that, that's about as deep as it's gone. And you always learn. I really, from where I'm sitting right now, I don't think we want to grow the space for the reasons that I just mentioned. You know, maybe, you know, you were there. Do you feel, if we had 1,000 people in there, I think we'd have a very different feeling.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Where you're, it's less about, you know, being actually in the space with the speakers and where the audience and your fellow audience members are part of the experience, and more of being at a show that's you're more removed from. And we don't really want that.
Also, the logistics of it might be a little bit difficult. I mean, it is hard to get people in and out of lunch in half an hour.
Well, you know, our hope is that actually gets easier as time goes on. You know, the logistics, as you suggest, the logistics of an event like that are challenging. They're really challenging, especially one that you're doing once a year, so you don't get to go up the learning curve and get super good at everything. That definitely, we're getting better from year to year. So hopefully that'll continue.
Do you guys have a feedback process for attendees? I mean, I haven't received any sort of feedback form about the event or anything like that.
Well, you probably received an email from Gold Star saying how was the event, because that's an automatic process. Yeah, so that's one level of feedback, is that because the event runs on the Gold Star system, it has that. So we've had pretty significant amount of feedback, mostly very positive. I think the last time I looked, it was 4.5 on a 5-point scale. So that's pretty good. On the event, and then we will be sending out another feedback form to attendees in the near future, and that's a TED requirement actually. So we'll be doing that as well. So there's I think also just the more informally, you know, you've got all the feedback that came through social media, which I don't know if you saw this, but TEDx Broadway was actually a trending topic on Twitter.
Online. Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I was wondering if there's ever been a Broadway conference or, you know, anything like that that's been a trending topic on Twitter. But we were there for a while on Monday, right up there with some sort of very famous names.
There was, I think, Broadway Swarm on Twitter was trending last year when they tried to coordinate some events. But you know, certainly on a Monday afternoon, it's got a good chance of trending.
Hey,
absolutely.
We'll take it.
And the audience that's there is a very plugged in audience, so you have high participation rates, especially with I've spoken with some other people who attended. You know, having a George Takei there is really really draws in a lot of people who are interested in this in social media and this topic.
Absolutely.
So what's your connection back to Broadway?
Well, you know. So we, you know what Gold Star does. We sell tickets to stuff, all kinds of stuff, live entertainment all over the country.
Sure.
And it turns out that theater is actually our number one category. It's not a dominant category, but it's we have a number of categories that we sell: sports, theater, performing arts, music, that kind of thing. And several of those categories are fairly equal in terms of what they make up of our sales. But theater is actually the number one among equals, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so, from our point of view, theater is an incredibly important category, and in some ways, Broadway is the leader, if you will, of theater. It's not the only. I mean, there's certainly in the commercial realm, there are a lot of great things happening outside of the Broadway environment in terms of theater, tremendously successful and also interesting and everything else. But Broadway is a big part of that as well. So our interest in the vitality of the community is because in many ways it's central to our business. And of course, the reason we're in this business is because these are things that we actually care about. So that I think from Gold Star's point of view, from my point of view, it's just a big part of what we do.
My question really was more about Jim McCarthy and less about Gold Star.
Sure, sure.
What's your connection to theater and Broadway?
I think, what do you mean? I mean, I've never been an actor, if that's what you're asking me.
You looked very, you emceed most of the TEDx Broadway and it looked like it was very natural to you. So I guess that was sort of my question is, do you have a theater background?
I don't have a theater background, but I've always had an interest in, and the reason that I'm doing what I was trying to say with the comment before is that the reason that I'm in this business is because it's all very interesting to me. You know what I mean? It's something that I've actually always found very interesting. And my approach and the approach of, my Gold Star co-founders was really from the direction of e-commerce rather than from the content itself. I have a background even before Gold Star, all the way back to GeoCities and e-commerce from the early days, working with, Amazon and everybody else. And so we came into the live entertainment business saying, this is a great, interesting field, and it needs, it needs some new dimensions to it, and that's what we've, tried to bring. But it's not a random thing that, I'm working in a field where it's about shows and about sports and about getting people out. And one of the things that I personally find very interesting is theater and performing arts and everything else. And so it's just really exciting for me to be part of it in a small way.
Is there any thought or talk about bringing TEDx Broadway to large regional areas such as Chicago or Boston or San Francisco or even London's West End?
Well, the way that the TEDx program works is that it's self-organized. So undoubtedly, there are lots of great TEDx organizers out there in all the places that you just mentioned. But our event, as you probably heard me and other people say a million times the other day, is not a theoretical or thematic event. It's about a location called Broadway. Mm-hmm. It's about this neighborhood that takes in many things, including the theater business part of it. So I would suggest that there are probably people who are really ideally suited to take up that same idea. I don't know if there's a TEDx West End, but if there is, I mean, obviously the focus would be on the whole neighborhood, if you will, just like our approach to Broadway is mm-hmm. holistic.
All right. So why don't you pitch us on Gold Star here as well as all of our listeners should go and sign up for a Gold Star account and get your emails outlining different value events that we can attend. There's also a lot of theater managers and planners and executives that listen to this as well. Should they sign up their theaters and bring them to Gold Star to move excess inventory?
Sure, they should. And really the right way to think of it from the point of view of a venue is that we are perhaps the largest channel of any kind that's devoted entirely to live entertainment ticket buyers. That's all we do. The only reason to sign up for Gold Star is to go out to live entertainment more. And so, from the point of view of a venue, we've got a terrific audience of people saying, help me go out more. And we get a lot of people buying a lot of tickets and going to a lot of shows that they otherwise wouldn't have gone to, which is really great. It makes us feel very proud that we're able to do that. And we do that for thousands of venues around the country and millions of people a year. So, I think it's a tremendous resource for the consumer. If you like to go out, what I say to consumers is if you like to go out, but you don't go out as much as you would like to, then Gold Star is kind of the answer to that, because it's a great source of information. It's a great source. Obviously, we often have great prices on things, but goes far beyond price to helping people just get through all those barriers between ending up sitting at home and actually being somewhere and doing something great. And of course, that benefits the venues too.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking some time out Sure. and talking about TEDx Broadway and Gold Star. And we look forward to anything you do in the future. Okay.
Well, I hope that people enjoyed it enough that they come back next year.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. So that kind of wraps up our reviews for this week. Anything coming up this week that in the future that you guys want to mention?
Oh, I'm going to see. Did I mention this? I'm going to Boston to see the Glass Menagerie with Cherry Jones, Zachary Quinto. Apparently, that's how it's pronounced. Celia Keenan Bolger, and even the gentleman caller is the wonderful young actor Brian Smith. So I am really looking forward to that.
All righty. We don't have any Broadway openings coming up until March 3rd, where Cinderella is opening next.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So the next couple of weeks, we'll be able to focus a little bit on other things before the madness of we have Cinderella on March 3rd and on March 7th, March 14th, Vanya, Sonia, and Masha and Spike, March 20th, Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, March 20th.
If that happens.
Yeah, if that happens. March 21st, Hands on a Hard Body. So you guys are going to have a very busy, it'll be March madness, if I can coin the term.
By the way, it's not Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, it's Rodgers plus Hammerstein's Cinderella. Have you noticed that?
No, did they put a plus?
Were they using an ampersand?
They
or what?
Put a plus sign in. And
like
I
in math.
And I actually questioned it, and I actually questioned Ted Chapin, and he said, yeah, just something new, you know, with our approval. But I don't know. When I see a plus sign in my head, my brain says plus. It doesn't say and.
Michael,
and,
so true.
And I don't know. I don't exactly understand what the motivation is. I mean, just to make it look cool. It makes it look like an architecture firm or something. But, you know, not to get started, but I just don't know if, you know, I don't know if we always have to turn our back on tradition is, I guess, my main point.
Well, they were the architects of the modern musical. So.
Hey, so the announcement this week that Alan Cumming, you'd mentioned Alan Cumming was at Cabaret, yeah. But Alan's doing a one-man Macbeth. And I was doing a little bit of research to get up on this. There's something along the lines of 50 different productions of Macbeth, you know, that are in the IBDB. But I guess that because it's a one-man Macbeth that this is interesting, and it's a limited engagement, so it's opening on April 21st. So that'll be part of the April madness. Let me see.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Tina Packer plays Lady Macbeth in Women of Will, and what's really skillful about her is that she shows that this is not a totally evil woman, because nobody is totally evil except the woman who stood in front of me at Manilow. So I think that's one of her most skillful interpretations.
According to the calendar that I'm looking at here, you two have 15 openings in April. So March might be madness, but April we'll have to.
It always is.
We'll come up with some other word there.
Sure.
Finished at the end with April 25th with Pippin at the Music Box. So we have lots of stuff coming up here.
Well, and I'm going to have a tough time because I'm going away for a week in April. I'm going to France to see Sunday in the Park with George and Amsterdam to see Aspects of Love, among other things. So,
wow. Aspects in Amsterdam, are they doing in English or in Dutch?
I think in Dutch.
Hmm. You think you'll like it better in Dutch?
It'll make just as much sense in a different language. So,
I have to say that Aspects is one of my favorite shows.
Oh, good.
It's very – I
– wow.
I'm very – you know, I look at that book and I read it over and over and over, the lyrics in the booklet, and I was like, none of this makes sense. But I love some of the songs and Aspects are very moving to me.
Good.
So, oh, by the way, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to Florida, and you may remember, I went, the last time I went, this is in the middle of basically nowhere in Florida, but there's a dinner theater there, and I can't remember the name of it. And the last time I went to this area where a friend of mine lives, I went to the dinner theater and I saw Gypsy. And this was the production where they, in order to cut down on the sets, you know, because they don't have the wherewithal, they didn't have a set for Rose's father's home, so she sang some people to him over the phone.
Now, when I saw a production in Seattle, yes, it was a dinner theater, I think. Now that I think of it, I think I was sitting at a table. What happened was, that I thought was very clever, and I even put it in my book, Let's Put On a Musical, as an option, is that he shows up at Uncle Jocko's Vaudeville Theater. He's followed her there, and they have the confrontation there.
Now,
that's not bad. Now, somebody might say, wait, what about the plaque? I mean, there's that whole business about taking the plaque off the wall, you know, so on and so forth. They talk about the plaque, and at the end of the scene, after he's left in disgust, she opens her pocketbook and takes out the plaque, showing that she's already taken it. And really, you know, considering that that's one set you have to build that you will never use again in the show, I thought this was a very smart decision, frankly. I like it a lot better than singing it over the phone, I'll tell you.
Well, but I'll have to tell you, that kind of worked too.
Oh, yeah?
It did. I don't remember. I actually don't remember. I think they just cut the plaque. So that's not a good thing. But other than that, it didn't really bother me tremendously.
All right. So let me wrap it up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us in another way, one way is to get the Stitcher app, which is for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and you can listen to us streaming there. We also are played on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. On our show notes page, we'll have links to everything we've talked about today, including that the interview on NPR with Barry Manilow, if you want to take a listen to that, and a link to Better Nate Than Ever and the Drama Bookshop reading on February 5th at 5:30 p.m. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Time.